You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Keith Boykin, who is a New York Times bestselling author, TV and film producer, and former CNN political commentator. Keith served in the White House, co-founded the National Black Justice Coalition, and taught at Columbia University. He's the author of 7 books. And his most recent, which we talk about, is called Why Does Everything Have to Be About Race? 25 Arguments That Won't Go Away. Really enjoyed this conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway. To the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Keith Boykin, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So I had a first question for you, but Nikki Haley changed everything this morning. And so we're recording this on Tuesday, January 16th. Where she was quoted this morning, I think it was a TV interview, by saying, quote, "We've never been a racist country," end quote. That doesn't feel right.
No, and she ruined my day, too, because I had a whole plan of things I was going to do. And then as soon as I saw that, I said, oh, damn it, I got to go do something about this. So I just came back in. I recorded a video, which I'm now editing, to post in response to what Nikki Haley said. But it's just such a patently false, obviously stupid comment that can't be ignored because it comes on the heels of another patently false, obviously stupid remark she made just last month, where she was speaking about slavery and failed to, speaking about the Civil War and failed to acknowledge that slavery was the cause of the Civil War and acted as though that were a hard question. And Nikki Haley should know better. She was a governor of South Carolina, the first state to secede from the Union. She was there when the flag, the Confederate flag, was taken down from the state capitol. You would think that she, of all people, would be in a position to know what's right and what's wrong about issues of race. But it's apparently true that her career has been hijacked by the MAGA movement of the Republican Party. So she feels like she can't say the truth. She can't say anything, I believe, that she would probably say under normal circumstances because she's afraid of what will happen to her, afraid of what will happen because of Trump's base.
You would think she just lived like don't say anything. Like that is, it is so absurd. And it's not even just slavery. I mean, there's a thing called internment camps. There's just like, And I don't know, again, the colonialism, call what you like, this is the world, certainly this country, of course, but I think what it factors into is the reason you wrote this book, because it's these kinds of arguments that just never seem to go away when you think we're evolving as a society and growing as a society. It's like, shouldn't we be able to get past these myths?
Well, it's hard to get past a myth when there are people invested in perpetuating those myths.
Yeah.
And I think we had an agreement, you know, for maybe the past few decades where both parties seem to be at least paying lip service to the idea that they would try to build a more racially just society. This was never the case in America before 1965, let's say, or 64. But since that time, the Republicans and Democrats, Richard Nixon actually sued the Trump administration for housing discrimination, or his administration did. Even Reagan, for all of his problems, and his racist behavior and policies, wasn't as bad as the presidential policies we see from some of the Republican candidates today. That's what's so disturbing. There's been a dramatic shift in the wrong direction, and a lot of it happened because of the election of the first black president, Barack Obama. After two, I mean, look for example at the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, bipartisan support from Democrats and Republicans. It was renewed multiple times in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Then we get to 2006. It's renewed for the last time, and Obama's elected 2 years later. Then after that, no Republican ever wants to support the renewal of the Voting Rights Act. You can't even get a basic majority of them, much less enough to pass a filibuster in the Senate for a legislation that passed 98-0 in Congress in the Senate the last time it came up. That's how dramatically different the Republicans are today from where they were just a decade and a half ago.
Yeah, and you opened your book with this, and it was actually my first question, because I was talking to my now 26-year-old son Nick, and I asked him if he remembered watching the television coverage when Barack Obama became president, here in Chicago, and he remembered me telling him something about remember this night as an incredible moment in history. And you write in your new book, quote, "Barack Obama has many talents, but erasing history is not one of them," end quote. So it's not that it wasn't an historic moment. It was, but it wasn't a panacea for hundreds of years of racism in this country. And in fact, as other people have pointed out, it did push us in probably this direction that we're in right now.
Well, and that's exactly right. One of my favorite books is White Rage by Carol Anderson. And she talks about how there are these periods in American history where white Americans become very upset with the progress that black people are making. And there's this backlash, or she calls it white rage. And we're seeing that right now. As a result of the Obama election, there has been a pendulum swing in the Republican Party that has moved Donald Trump into the presidency, moved him now into the position to be the nominee to be president again for the Republican Party. But it's also changed the rest of the party. Just 8 years ago, was it? Yeah, 8 years ago when Donald Trump ran for, okay, I've lost track of time. It's been such a crazy 8 years.
I haven't
But
7 years
since
yet.
Donald Trump first ran for president, Republicans were almost uniformly condemning him. People in positions of power say, oh, he'll never be elected. He's not who we are. Even Nikki Haley was out there saying, Donald Trump is not the type of person we would elect as president. I tell my children to be different from Donald Trump. And then she goes and serves his administration. Then she leaves and condemns him. Then she supports him again. Then she runs against him. And then she decides that if he is convicted, she'll pardon him. And may run for vice president as his running mate. So there's no consistency at all from the party in terms of how we deal with issues of race.
And there's a stunning line in the book. I did not know this. Quote, "No Democratic candidate for president has won the white vote since 1964. Not Jimmy Carter, not Bill Clinton, not Barack Obama in either of his two presidential elections." Did you know that? You have to look that up.
I've been talking about this for years. I'm surprised how many people don't believe that when I say it.
It's
I,
un.
I, I it's one of those things you study in political science. This is I graduated from college in 1987. It was true in the 80s when studying presidential politics then. Nothing has changed since that time. I worked for Bill Clinton in his two presidential elections. He lost the white vote, even though he was a white Southerner, who was one of the good old boys. But he still lost the white vote. And of course, Barack Obama, despite all the claims that he's somehow reparations for hundreds of years of slavery and segregation, white people didn't even vote for him. The majority of white people voted against him in both of his elections, but they voted for Donald Trump. So what am I supposed to think as a black person living in this country when people are voting for the racist white supremacist who spent 5.5 years lying about the first black president's birth certificate and tried to lock up five innocent black and brown teenagers in Central Park? Or but won't vote for the black guy who graduated from Harvard Law School, was a president of the Harvard Law Review, United States Senator, and distinguished author who has done nothing and comes from a biracial family and has done nothing but try to bring our country together.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to think about that as an American, as a black American, about how white Americans see me? The majority.
You dedicate this book to Derrick Bell. Can you tell us about him?
Derrick Bell was one of my law professors in law school at Harvard. He was a founder of the critical race theory movement. I don't think it was called that when he first started, but there are other people who came along later who put that label on it. And he was an activist as a scholar. He a few times took leaves of absence from his jobs, including at Harvard, to protest discrimination he saw in the faculty. He previously served in the NAACP as a member of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, legal staff. And he wrote some, provocative pieces challenging the persistence of racism. And he produced or introduced what I remember as the interest convergence theory, the idea that white Americans and white people in general, I suppose, but I think he's focused it on white Americans, will do the right thing only when it meets their interest. So there are times when, electing a black president or hiring a black CEO or whatever may suit the interest of the institution. That's when white Americans will do the right thing, but not necessarily just out of basic altruism.
And this, I so when the critical race theory sort of came up, I'm like, I'm gonna look into this. And I just couldn't believe that this somewhat obscure legal idea would ever find its way into a primary school education, and it hasn't, right?
Well, in primary school, I just can't even imagine that. Like, how it's
High school.
inconceivable. High school, I could see how, but I studied critical race theory in law school. I have a video of myself from one of the local Boston TV stations in Derrick Bell's class, where we're talking about some critical race theory themes. And the fascinating thing is, I enjoyed his class. It was really exciting because he taught it a different way from traditional legal style. But the texts we read, the law review articles we read, there were serious pieces about anti-discrimination litigation and interest convergence theory or intersectionality. They're not, high school, secondary, even, definitely not primary level educational materials. So the idea that they're Are grade school kids or middle school kids or even high school kids who are learning about critical race theory from their teachers, it's just absurd on its face. Now, of course, the definition of what critical race theory is has evolved over time. It's left the legal field and moved into other forms of scholarship. But critical race theory is not what people have made it out to be. The other really weird thing about this, which I'm just now discovering in the past 2 weeks or so, is that I wrote about the guy who started the critical race theory scare in my book. I didn't mention his name, but
No, you won't.
I didn't mention his name because I didn't think anybody knew about him. Wasn't a big deal. Like, I just explain what happened, how he went on Fox News and he talked about critical race theory. Donald Trump saw what he said. And then Donald Trump created this whole sort of campaign against it, a few years ago. That's where I thought I was going to leave off. But that guy who started this whole scare, his name is Chris Ruffo. And
Chris Ruffo,
he's
of
the
course.
guy who led the effort to drive out Claudine Gay as the president of Harvard. So I kind of wish I'd mentioned his name because I had no idea he was going to blow up and become this big of a figure in the right wing. But it's a scary thought that he's able to go from one issue to another and create these controversies in different communities.
Yeah, I mean, the attack on DEI is oh God, I don't even know how to describe it. I recall being in a DEI workshop here, and one of my bosses at the time, who was a very wealthy, privileged, white, cisgender man, said, "I don't see race," and or "I don't see color." I think it was "I don't see color." And I remember feeling like this is a step removed from an office sketch, and I'm in a comedy theater, what is happening? And I really loved, you quote Colin Seal, who wrote of Dr. King, that he wanted to create a world, quote, where people are not colorblind, but color kind, which is really lovely. But can you talk a little bit about this? Like what is so, again, absurd about the idea that one doesn't see color or race?
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin with that, because there's so many different levels and layers. Yeah. But, you know, I just came back from Atlanta yesterday. I was there for the King Day weekend. And I went to the Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Dr. King preached, and to King's tomb at the King Center. And it was a reminder to me that Dr. King was a person who believed in social justice. And he didn't believe in this myth that people try to create. He just wanted everybody to be colorblind and never to see color. You know, that one line they always quote, that he wanted people to be judged by the content of the character, not the color of their skin, completely misunderstands the rest of his life's history and work. But the other part about it is that we all see color. Dr. King saw color. He spoke about being black and said that black is beautiful. He went to an HBCU, Morehouse College. Everyone sees color. Even people who are technically colorblind are able to distinguish physical traits that differentiate people based on what we call their race or color. So from a perfectly sort of technical point of view, everyone does, and it's ridiculous to say you don't. But from an even different point of view, a more abstract point of view, even if you somehow are managed not to see color, everyone else in the world does. Everyone else in our country does. Our whole society in this country was built on the concept of color. When the Supreme Court decided in the Dred Scott case in 1857 that black people did not have equal rights in this country, how were they supposed to enforce that unless they saw color? How were the segregation laws enforced in our country, where whites can only drink at this fountain or go to this lunch counter, if people didn't see color? And to think that somehow, because Congress passed a law in 1964, the Civil Rights Act, that suddenly everyone put on these blinders and no longer can see color, is just preposterous. And it's part of this racial fantasy that we have to get out of, this mindset that says that we don't have to do anything, any sort of hard work to change this. We just have to sort of acknowledge that things are okay and equal right now and move on and pretend the past didn't happen.
I thought you had a really elegant way of talking about racism, and it comes from a law professor you had who did this with an analogy about a magnet. Can you tell us about it? I think that's a way that maybe people can find a metaphor that's useful for them.
You know, the sad thing about this, I remember hearing this at least a decade ago or so, and I cannot remember who said it. And I remember when I was writing the book, I was looking online, did Google searches everywhere. I couldn't find who said it. So I know I heard it, but I can't attribute to the person who said it. But basically, the point is, the law professor explained that racism for people of color, particularly black people, is equivalent to carrying a big magnet over your shoulders. You remember those big red horseshoe magnets from science class in high school? Well, if you have one of those, a huge, large magnet, for example, you put it over your shoulder and you walk around town anywhere on any given day, you're going to notice something different from almost everyone else in the world. You're going to notice there's a lot of metal in the world, because a lot of metal will suddenly be attracted to you. It won't be attracted to anyone else, but it's coming to you. Maybe even, you know, you'll be attracted to it too, because cars and doors and cell phones and all kinds of other things that are metal will be clinging to you. And you'll be assaulted by this on a daily basis. Meanwhile, everyone else is walking around the world completely oblivious to the fact that there's all this metal that is affecting you, because they're not dealing with it. And that's the functional equivalent of what black people deal with racism. That, yes, it's not something that's visible to everybody just sort of walking down the street, but we're still assaulted by it on a regular basis. The way the police interact with us, the way the taxi cab drivers choose to pick us up or not pick us up, the way we're treated when we walk into a department store, or the way that just ordinary people just see us in an elevator, you know. So there's a whole sort of a layer to understanding race, which means you have to get beyond your own sort of mindset and your own sort of mentality and see it from someone else's perspective.
I think that's so powerful, because it creates a kind of a story, right? And we think in stories, and stories are so hugely powerful for us. And in the your ninth argument, which is yes, European immigrants struggled, but they were not slaves. I had this overwhelming sense memory of relatives on my Irish side telling these foundational stories about Irish need not apply.
Yeah.
To this day, and we're the same age, graduated college right around the same time. But it's like, and I'm like, oh, that makes sense in a whole different way right now in terms of needing to talk about that, especially at a time well past where anyone was not going to get hired because they were Irish, you know, and this is in the 70s and the 80s when I'm hearing these stories. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that plays out in the book?
Yeah, well, this is a fascinating one for me because it's not something that, you know, I don't really know anybody in my personal life who's ever said this. I've seen this argument in public settings, but nobody I've ever met has ever told me this before. The argument is that the Irish people were slaves too, and we're not bitching and moaning about racism and prejudice. We just got over it. You know, we pulled ourselves up from the bootstraps, with our bootstraps. Well, the truth is, yes, Irish people were oppressed and they were treated as second class citizens when they came here, as were many other European Americans and people who were not from Europe. But over time, two things happened. First, Irish Americans were able to assimilate into something called whiteness in this country, which Black people were not able to do. But secondly, Irish Americans were never slaves in this country. Yes, there were some Irish Americans who were indentured servants, which is not the same thing as chattel slavery, which is a permanent hereditary condition that you pass on to your successors, as opposed to indentured servitude, where you have to work for a period of time to pay off a debt, and then you get your freedom, but your children are free. That's not the condition that Black people dealt with in chattel slavery. Right? If you were an enslaved person, your children were enslaved, your grandchildren were enslaved. You had no ability to get out of that. And in order to perpetuate that system, the country, the society had to create a mentality, a racist mentality that justified your oppression, that justified it because you were not worthy of being free, that you didn't have the capability of thinking for yourself, of making decisions for yourself, or you were too lazy to be able to or undisciplined to be able to work, or that you were too criminally disposed to be able to be trusted in society. So there are all these sort of racist rumors and stereotypes and myths that get perpetuated in order to justify slavery that don't exist when we're talking about the mistreatment and unjust treatment of Irish Americans and other immigrants who came to this country.
So another cudgel that people use is the welfare issue. And you talk about that in the book, and I think that that's where like the statistics and the facts are kind of important, because I mean, you know, for those of us who grew up around these sort of famous political stories about the welfare queens, right, that became such a provocative thing, and it became ingrained in this idea, and it's still used as a talking point. So talk about that myth.
Well, the welfare queen myth, I think it starts pretty much around the time of 1976 with Ronald Reagan's campaign. I mean, it probably existed for many years before that, but it becomes a popular national myth around the mid-1970s. And Ronald Reagan runs for president. He tells a story about this woman in Chicago who has got, I don't know, I can't remember what it is now, 90 aliases or something like that. A number, she's receiving Social Security checks and unemployment checks and all kinds of other types of assistance. And she's doing it fraudulently. Now, there was an actual woman that this story was based off of. And Ronald Reagan, of course, distorted the story beyond recognition. But it resonated with a lot of white Americans because it perpetuated the sense of victimhood. This idea that, yeah, we're the ones who are oppressed, not those Black people and those Hispanic people. We're the ones, we're the hardworking taxpayers who built this country, and we're giving our hard-earned money so that those people can have babies and collect welfare checks. Now, the reality of it all that people don't like to talk about, but it's so patently obvious if you just know anything about not even statistics, but the basic demographics of America. America's only 13% Black. And so it's almost inconceivable that you could think that the most people in the country who are on welfare would be Black, because there's millions and millions and millions more white people than are Black people. So of course, white people are the majority of people who receive welfare. But you say that, and white people sometimes just are very uncomfortable with that idea because they've associated welfare with blackness. And they've been taught to think that because society continues to portray that image over and over again.
Well, then you take that to the next leap, which is reparations, and that just people go bonkers for that. When you bring up like reparations have existed forever, and in fact were given to slave owners.
That was one of the things. I mean, I don't think I remembered learning that when I was in college, or law school, but I
Doesn't
did
get
learn
talked about a lot.
that. I'm
It doesn't
sorry.
get talked. It doesn't get talked about a lot.
No, it doesn't. I don't think I really even remember hearing the discussion about the issue of reparations until Randall Robinson in the late 1990s wrote a book called The Debt. And then Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece in The Atlantic of, like maybe a decade ago or so. I can't remember exactly when, but for a long period of time, well, I'll just say that in my lifetime, there was virtually, I remember hearing virtually nothing about reparations. But what the truth is that Black people have been demanding reparations almost since the beginning of the country, and not receiving them. But the first time the country really gave out reparations for slavery was not to Black people, but to white people who lost the value of their property when President Lincoln signed the Emancipated, I forgot the term, the 1863 law, the 1863 law that emancipated Black people in the District of Columbia. In order to justify that, they had to pay compensation to the people who were deprived of their property. If you look at the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause requires that private property should not be taken without compensation. Now, arguably, they could have said that this was not private property; you can't own humans, so we're not gonna compensate you. But they chose to compensate the slave owners who actually held Black people, as opposed to the enslaved people themselves. For the Black people, what they did is they offer you a trip, a ticket out of the country, and I think it was $100 to get out of Dodge. But they had no interest in really compensating Black people for the hundreds of years of forced labor, free labor, to benefit the building of this country.
And the government gives money to people all the time for different, whether it's farmers or whether it's New Deal activities or this is not this. I guess it's radical only in the sense that it's always been done.
Well, it's radical when it comes to Black people. I mean, Dr. King talks about this, about if you go back to the land grant acts of the 1860s, how the federal government was giving out millions and millions of acres of federally owned land to white people to do whatever they want with it, to farm it, to till it, to develop it. And those are the people who live in our Midwest of America today and other parts of our country, the Great Plains, but they were giving that land out to white people. And it wasn't a problem then to have welfare then. If you even look at other examples in the 1930s, when the Social Security Act was passed, there was some opposition from conservatives who didn't like the idea, but Americans really liked the idea of giving out money to people who were elderly, especially people who felt like they should get something after the Great Depression. Even though Black people were largely excluded from Social Security at first because it excluded domestic workers and agricultural workers where Black people tended to work. And that was because of the white Southerners and Democratic Southerners who didn't want Black people to benefit from it. If you look at the GI Bill in the 1940s, we were giving out loan guarantees so that former soldiers, veterans could buy homes. And so we were giving out money so they could go to college. We were building suburbs and creating infrastructure for white people to move with federal government dollars to leave the money, to take the money out of the cities and direct it to the suburbs to build up these communities in the suburbs. And people were accepting that money. They accepted money from Medicare. They had no problem with all these things when that came along. The only time when giving out money becomes a problem is when Black people start to receive that money. Starting in the 1960s, When we start to have a more equal society, then, oh no, we can't do that. That's welfare. We built ourselves up from our, lifted ourselves up from our bootstraps. We would never take any government assistance after hundreds of years of taking government assistance and stealing our labor. Oh no, we would never do anything like that. It's, the insult is stunning, but that's a type of hypocrisy that people are able to live with in their minds and able to perpetuate and justify, their privilege.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we go there, I remember my friend Kim Scott, who wrote the book Radical Candor, was working on her follow-up to the book, and her editor was blind. And he was pointing out to her how many times she used these sight metaphors inside her book. And it was just sort of something she wasn't that conscious of. And very soon after that, I interviewed a pal who was working doing improv for people who were blind, and she caught me on a couple of things like, oh, this, and I'm like, oh, I want to remember this because metaphors are so important and words are so important because they drive our culture, which drives our behavior. And you have a whole section about this things that we've all heard, which is someone who says that person doesn't have a racist bone in their body, which is also cousins, I guess, to, you know, I know their heart. Bones don't tell us if someone's racist or not, but the other side of that, right, is what they're trying to say is, oh no, like this is a fact because it's a bone, it's part of their makeup, but it just can't be true.
Yeah, this one is really baffling to me. I thought this was dead. And I almost didn't put it in the book, except I think it's so funny to me. It's just so stupid, but I put it in because of that. But I was like, oh, people won't get it because nobody really says this anymore. And then just a couple of weeks ago, Chris Christie is asked a question about Nikki Haley and her refusal to admit that slavery was the cause of the Civil War. And Chris Christie defends Nikki Haley by saying, I know Nikki Haley, she doesn't have a racist bone in her body. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, people are still saying this. I can't believe they're actually saying this. And, you know, I use examples in the book. I don't want to tell this story because it was one of my favorite stories in the book is the story of this guy, Earl Butz, who I won't tell the whole story, but I knew nothing about Earl Butz before I wrote this book. I don't even know how I came across that story, but the moment I heard it, I was like, oh my God, this is so perfect. But the idea that people who don't have a racist bone in their body, that myth, it's usually perpetrated by people who have just been caught in some sort of egregiously racist behavior, or saying something that's patently offensive. And then someone comes to their defense, or sometimes they say it about themselves, as in the case of Donald Trump. And someone comes up and says, oh, that person, he's a good guy. She's a good person. He doesn't have a racist bone in their body. First of all, how do you know whether somebody has any racism in their hearts? Second of all, no one has racist bones. Bones are not what make people racist. It's our behaviors and our ideas and things like that. But thirdly, the idea that anyone in this country could go through a lifetime through adulthood and not be affected by the racism that is so pervasive in society is just completely implausible. When I wrote this book, it was an argument that was sort of time limited because I talked about people who were born in the early 1900s, people Ronald Reagan, for example, or even Earl Butz, or even later on in the 1900s, when you talk about people like Donald Trump, they're like, of course, how could you live in this country through segregated America and not have a racist bone in your body, or a racist thought, or racist idea, or racist belief? But here we are in 2024, and people still are saying the same thing. It's kind of scary that people haven't learned anything. So maybe I'll have to send a copy of the book to Chris Christie and Nikki Haley.
You absolutely should. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
So just to be clear, I want to make sure I get this right. The yes and story is a time when I could have said no, but chose to say yes. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay. Well, you know, it's funny because I mentioned this to you before we actually started that my whole life is kind of based on yes and stories because I've made so many decisions that probably I don't even know if I could have or couldn't have. I just, they're not the logical things to do. But I think the one that comes to mind is when I left the White House. I worked in the White House for a few years in the Clinton administration. And I enjoyed it for the most part. It's a lot of work, but yeah, I enjoyed it. But I left that job because I got an offer for a not as good offer to work for a nonprofit as executive director of a nonprofit that had no money to pay me, by the way. I was just tired of working for the White House, even though it's kind of a hard thing to say now because people think, how could you leave a job working in the White House and go do that? But I knew that there was something else out there for me. And even though I really enjoyed the job, I enjoyed the pay I was getting because I was had a steady paycheck working for the government. I just felt it was important for me to try something different, try something new. So I left the job. I wrote a book. I thought the book was going to help pay for my expenses. Didn't pay for my expenses because the way the books work, you don't get money until months and months, sometimes years after they come out. I didn't know that at the time. It was my first book. And I took this job and I was struggling. I really had no way to support myself. And I started to really second guess what I was doing and why I left a steady government job to go pursue this dream. But I am so glad I did it because that one decision, leaving the path that I was already on, really changed the trajectory of my life and put me on a path where I was able to sort of find my own way, still finding my own way. And I'm just very thankful that I'm able to say yes and not no to some of the opportunities that come to me.
I love that. The book is called Why Does Everything Have to Be About Race? 25 Arguments That Won't Go Away. Keith Boykin, thanks for coming up on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.